Thank you for calling.
Diversity Consignment.
Cannot come to the phone right now. We're busy interviewing local artists, influencers, and business owners. Please leave your name and number after the beep.
Hey, Ian. It's Jared. Looking forward to doing an interview later on. So can you just give me a call back when you get a chance?
In episode 1 of the Basement Buzz podcast, I interview coffee enthusiast and local business owner Jared Mancini. Jared is the owner and operator of Sip Cafe, located in the heart of the financial district of Boston. Jared explains how he went from a silly, flighty youth to the successful cafe slash beer garden owner he is today. Let's get started. All right, Jared, thank you for coming over here today and joining us on the Basement Buzz podcast. Really glad to have you, man.
Oh, it's great to be here, man. Thanks for asking me.
How was your trip over here?
Oh, it was great. Got here a little early, so was able to stop by Ula Cafe, an old favorite stomping grounds. Got a couple of nice pastries and a coffee. And yeah, I lived in JP for 10 years, so it's just sort of nice to get back. Love this town. It's a great place.
So you live close by now?
Yeah, I mean, still, we live over in Brookline. Once we had children, you know, we moved over to Brookline. And yeah, it's about 10 minutes, so
nice.
Not far at all.
So tell our listeners a little bit about who you are and what you do.
Yeah, so once again, my name is Jared Mancini. I own a cafe called Sip Cafe in downtown Boston. And basically, for 10 years, it was a coffee shop, you know, pastries, salads, sandwiches, etc. And then about 3 years ago, I brought in a business partner and we started offering beer and wine. And that's a big part of the business now. So
nice. Cool.
Yeah.
So let's go back in time for a bit. Tell us where it all began. So who was Jared like in high school, for instance?
Oh, God. That's a question I'm always wondering myself, to be honest.
Like, how would people, like, your best friends perceive you in high school, would you say?
Yeah. No, I mean, the funny thing is I have actually asked them this in the years since. Like, I have a really close group from high school, and, you know, we keep in touch still. But, yeah, I think I was, you know, sort of friends with everybody. You know, I played soccer. That was sort of my thing. You know, a little... probably silly, considered a little flighty, not the most uber-focused person, that's for sure.
Yeah. So when you went to, like, college, would you say that's kind of where it changed and you became a little bit more focused, or did it take, like, more time than that?
I think that definitely helped. College was pretty impactful for me as far as just shaping who I am today.
Where did you go to school?
I went to University of Rhode Island.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so just my state school, and that sort of was, once again, me being not super motivated, not applying to a lot of schools, and just sort of, I guess, I don't want to say settling, but sort of defaulting to my state school.
Yeah. So you grew up in Rhode Island.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I grew up in Bristol, Rhode Island, and home of, you know, the big 4th of July celebrations every year, where the town, you know, quadruples in size.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't know about the Bristol 4th of July.
So, oh, yeah.
I grew up in the Plymouth area.
Right,
where
right.
We have, obviously, it's America's hometown.
Oh, okay. Right, yeah,
how does
Plymouth,
it compare
of course.
Have you ever been to the Plymouth one?
I haven't, actually.
You haven't been to the Plymouth?
No, is it a big,
really?
Is it a big, like...
Oh, it's huge. I mean,
really?
They have people, yeah, it's huge. The streets are packed. The fireworks are great. I was just at it this year.
No kidding. Because it's funny, when you grow up in your own little world, like, I always thought... I still, to this day, I guess, think of Bristol as the 4th of July celebration.
Yeah.
So, I don't know.
It might be, though. I mean, I've never been to the Bristol one, so I don't know how it compares.
So, for example, like, our hometown is normally, I think, 20 to 30,000 population, and during the parade, apparently, it will grow to 200,000.
Wow.
For, like, three or four days around there. Yeah,
that's definitely huge.
The parade itself is about 2.5 hours long. It used to be on NBC and stuff.
Wow. Yeah. Cool. Yeah, no, I got to check it out. I mean, I'm always looking for things to new places to go and stuff. It's just hard when you've got Boston so close, the Plymouth one, which I know about.
Yeah, of course.
You know, to dedicate such a big holiday day to like, all right, let's check out the Bristol one. But if you say it's good, then I will definitely go check it out.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think a lot of it has to do with nostalgia too, though. You know, you go back, see your friends from, you know, growing up.
Yeah, sure, of course. So back to college. What did you study in college?
Yeah, so I, coming out of high school, I wasn't sure what I wanted to do, and I had physical therapy in my mind. I just gravitated towards sports. My sister and dad took up the artist sort of niche in the family, so I felt like that wasn't an option. So I thought physical therapy, went to college, and they didn't offer that as an undergrad program. So I minored in philosophy, and then I majored in what was called human science and services. So it was, obviously, as it sounds, pretty broad, sort of generic. I mean, it was everything from anatomy to physics to women and children in poverty. So it was like a big range of stuff.
Yeah, but that's still good to get a wide range of, like, you know, studies.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I mean, and that's when I was sort of becoming my own person and definitely, you know, growing up a lot, meeting people from all, you know, around the country and in some cases around the world. So it definitely shaped me significantly.
So how was the college experience for you?
It was great. I had a blast. I mean, very social, you know, a lot of partying, having fun with people.
How'd you do in school? Were you like an A student?
No, I was probably like a B plus. Yeah. I mean, I think I graduated with it ended up being a 3.1.
Still pretty good.
Yeah. Not bad. I mean,
4.0 scale, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Because nowadays they have like 5.3 and stuff like that. With the college level.
Yeah, it gets crazy for sure. But no, this is old, just like classic, 4.0 scale.
Yeah, so 3.1 is pretty good. Yeah. So you did spend some time actually focusing on your studies too.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, I think I could have applied myself more, but the classes that I ended up really enjoying, I, you know, applied myself, you know, much more than the other, you know, some of the other classes, for example.
So obviously you didn't use or you didn't, you know, pursue necessarily a career in the fields that you studied.
Exactly. At one point I took an intro to philosophy class and, you know, it was okay. But then I took a social philosophy class, which I loved. So I ended up minoring in it. And at one point I actually did think, oh, maybe, you know, what can I do with this? You know, and I thought maybe teaching or, you know, the academic world.
Mm-hmm. I find philosophy to be very interesting. I mean, because there's like the ancient philosophy, right? Like,
of course,
Socrates and Plato type of thing. And then there's also like you can apply it to modern day.
Absolutely. Yeah. So yeah, I think I related more to the modern philosophers, and maybe that's just because it was closer in time to me. You know?
Yeah.
But
because one of my favorite classes that I actually took in college was a philosophy class, and teacher was like, he had written his book, so like the book that he wrote was pretty much like the curriculum, and you know, it was very interactive and definitely based more on modern philosophy than it was on like ancient history philosophy. I found it very interesting, and so
I agree. And I mean, I had this one teacher in particular that I just loved. Shout out to Galen Johnson. He was a very impactful person at that time, especially. And so what would happen is I took this one class by him, loved it. And then I would follow him. Like basically, like if he had a class, I would just take it.
Yeah.
So that's how I ended up minoring. Essentially, it was just like I accumulated enough credits where I was like one class away at one point. All right.
Yeah, no, but it's good to have teachers like that, you know, that really make an impact on you. So, like, would you say that your knowledge of what you've learned in school has really helped you outside of school?
I would say yes. I think maybe not the specific knowledge, but I think the big thing that college did for me was allow me to sort of learn how to learn, if that makes sense, to know where to go, how to pursue knowledge, you know, basically.
That is the definition of philosophy, isn't it? The pursuit of knowledge.
There you go.
Yeah. So transitioning back, like so where were you after school?
Yeah, so basically after school I was at home, you know, back at my parents.
Back in Bristol?
Yeah, I'd had a sort of bad car accident. I guess it was in the summer after I graduated, I think, if I remember correctly. And or maybe it was the fall. But anyways, I was back at home for about a year, sort of figuring things out. I was substitute teaching. And actually, at one point, I applied to a grad program in elementary education at Rhode Island College. And, got accepted and was about to pursue that. And then took a drive, ended up moving up to Boston. Had an opportunity and just sort of went with it. So
Yeah. So what kind of, that was, must have been a pivotal point in your life, right?
Oh, huge, huge. Literally life-changing.
Yeah.
So many ways.
Was it like to the point where you're lucky to be alive kind of situation or?
Oh, you mean
I'm talking about the car accident.
I would say so. The car was totaled. Luckily I was by myself. Had someone been with me in the passenger side, that was sort of crushed in. So,
wow.
Yeah, it was one of those days where I felt like I used up a lot of luck, whatever luck I had in the bank.
You were working on your final life your nine lives.
Right, exactly.
That's crazy, though.
Yeah, yeah, no, for sure. I think that made me, I don't know, take things a little more seriously, probably, for sure.
Yeah, yeah. What age was that around?
About 22.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, yeah. I mean, I had a very, not as, probably traumatic experience, but around that same age is when I got, my DUI, and that's kind of, what grounded me in a lot of ways, too, was, when you go through something that really, affects you and your life and probably people around you, too.
Absolutely. I mean, I can remember I got a D, they called it a DUI. Or I guess that's what you said.
Yeah, DUI, yeah.
Just taking those classes, my grandfather was driving me, and it was just so, I just felt so small inside and just so ashamed and, embarrassed
totally.
About the whole situation.
I know. And you start to think this is not me. This is not who I am. Right?
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah. Well, you wonder, you can see how you can go different, take that turn right either way, right. or left. And
right. Yeah, no, totally. So you moved from Bristol to Boston.
Mm-hmm.
So that was around the same time?
Yeah, I would say, so I had the car accident. Let's say it's in the fall. I'm pretty sure it was in the fall because I had some friends doing the five-year plan, and I had seen them that night. So
who made that? Was that your decision? You were like, you know what, I got to get out of here? Or was that kind of were you influenced by other people to make that decision?
Great question. So it was a combination, I would say. My parents and my father specifically was talking to my mother and we got to give Jared a little kick in the butt because, I feel like he might be being a little too comfortable, living with us.
Yeah.
And my mother's response was, oh, he's a great roommate though, And my dad was just like, yeah, he is, but
Yeah.
We gotta, he needs a little push. And so there was that impetus. It was sort of all these things at once. And then I got accepted to the grad program. But then all of a sudden, on a dime, it was the summer. I had just turned 23. And I was working for this internet company doing an internship. Mm-hmm. And then my friend's wife told me, hey, Jared, they're going to have opportunities. If you want a full-time job, you can move up to Boston. Specifically Somerville, at the time it was, I think the salary was maybe $33,000 plus some sales incentives, which for me was just insane,
right.
It's like this is hey I got
a career now,
yeah, exactly,
kind of thing. Yeah, so what were you doing at so you did take that leap?
I did, yeah.
And you moved to Somerville. It's a cool part of the city.
Well, I should say I actually lived in Dorchester.
Oh, okay. Actually, that's much different.
Yeah, I lived on Savin Hill. They used to call it Stab and Kill, I guess, was the joke. But it was already gentrifying a bit at that point. And
mm-hmm. So you were commuting from Dorchester to Somerville?
Yep. I'd jump on the Red Line. I loved it. I didn't have a car. I didn't need to worry about a car. I really enjoyed using the T back then.
Yeah. Did you? So you lived in Dorchester, and how did you like this job at that time?
Yeah, I mean, it was great. So I was doing sales for them. It was sort of almost hard to explain. It was sort of like, it was an internet company or had visions of doing stuff online. I mean, we actually had early e-commerce. It was actually before Amazon, I guess. We were essentially just selling a collegiate guidebook, though. So it was like this coupon book, sort of. But what it was essentially you'd go to the local businesses and say, hey, you know, Diversity Consignment, do you want to offer 20% off your first purchase type thing to an incoming student, you know, and try to get them as a customer. So that was sort of the mindset.
Oh, so you were distributing it directly to like the student body?
Exactly.
Yeah, gotcha.
As best we could. And I mean, a lot of it was restaurant based, you know, so the idea is buy one burrito, get the next one half off type thing.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Oh, that's a cool idea. Is the company still around?
The funny thing is, it actually is. So they went through a couple, we started focusing on the corporate perk side.
Yeah.
And at one point, we had expanded to major cities like San Francisco, Chicago, New York, little pilot offices or, you know, with manned by like two or three people. And eventually they closed everything down. We all pretty much got laid off except for like four or five of them. But I found out to this day they're down in New York and, you know, pretty successful working through HRs in various companies and doing what they call corporate perks.
Nice. Yeah. So how long were you working there?
I think it was really just not too long, much longer than a year and a half maybe.
All right. So working there for like a year, year and a half or so. And then they kind of laid you off. Is that what happened?
Yeah. Everyone.
Basically. Everyone got laid off?
Yeah, everyone got laid off. And so I all of a sudden was without a job.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember if I even knew to collect unemployment back then, but...
So now you're still in Dorchester at this point.
Yep. Still in Dorchester. So at one point, my area of sales was sort of Newbury Street area, Back Bay.
Okay.
So I sort of knew that street. And so there was this teeth whitening place, and I knew the manager, and I used to, like, hang out there sometimes. So, mm-hmm. like, well, especially now that I was unemployed, I was just sitting there. I was working on my resume, actually, at his computer at, like, the front desk where people would come in.
Yeah.
And I'd greet, like, potential customers and stuff. And he, you know, he didn't seem to mind. And so one night he said, oh, let's go grab drinks. You know, I want to introduce you to my friend Jessica.
Okay.
So go grab drinks. Turns out Jessica is managing this cafe called Torre Fazione Italia.
Mm.
And it's a West Coast-based chain. They have this one outpost in Boston. And so she's from Victoria on the West Coast and in Canada. And she wants to essentially get back home. So she's sort of actively looking for a replacement.
Okay, yeah.
So he had told her I'd worked in restaurants, et cetera, you know, growing up. And so she was pitching to me the idea. She's like, hey, you need a job. Why don't you come in and check us out, you know?
Sure.
See if you might be interested in interviewing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
And, was that just as, like, floor staff kind of entry level?
No, she was going to replace her. So she just thought, if I liked it, maybe I could apply to be the manager.
Wow.
Which was a big leap.
Yeah, no, totally. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, going in, because you had really didn't have much managerial experience.
No.
And a lot of times people have a degree in management.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. But, I mean, that kind of just goes into, like, you know, who you know can get you in the door.
Oh, absolutely. And the timing of things. Yeah. And, I mean, but I always remember this, that you did need a four-year, you needed a bachelor's degree. So I always justify my college education by saying, hey, like, had I not had that, I wouldn't have even
been in that position.
Exactly.
Yeah, totally. So you, there's this cafe.
Yeah, now. So there's this cafe on Newbury Street. So she tells me, hey, why don't you just come in? You know, you're not doing anything tomorrow. I know you're not working. I'm like, all right, fair enough.
Right.
So I go in there, and it's this beautiful place with all Italian ceramics everywhere. And I remember you walk down these stairs, and she makes me what is my first latte ever. Mm-hmm. I mean, I grew up with Dunkin' Donuts.
New England runs on Dunkin', man.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, really not the best quality coffee, but I didn't know any better. So she made me a latte, beautiful design in it, probably a heart or something. And I'm just blown away. I'm, like, captivated, you know, by the whole experience. And I was really sold right then, essentially. And, you know, so she told me she was going to get her district manager down to, you know, he's going to come down to do some interviews. So,
yeah.
So I signed up for that.
Must have been a busy place. I mean, it was on Newbury Street, right?
Yeah, it definitely was, especially back then. Excuse me. Newbury Street in general was really busy. I mean, that was before 9/11.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, the street had a lot of money on it, you know, a lot of Middle Eastern money and stuff. A lot of the street changed, in my opinion, after 9/11.
Really?
Pretty significantly. Yeah.
Really? So going back now, you're going into this. So you accepted the role.
Yeah, yeah. So basically, this guy Davide Bonamici comes down and interviews me. You
what
know,
a great name.
Straight out of Rome, and I mean, an awesome guy, like a mentor for sure. So, and I think between him and the cafe, and you know, I'm half Italian, so I was just intrigued by the whole situation.
Sure.
And yeah, it was myself and this one other guy it came down to, and I remember seeing the other kid interview, and he had. You know, I think he had a lot more actual managerial experience.
Sure.
Which didn't take much since I had none.
Right, yeah.
But yeah. but I just saw him and I thought he looked kind of like, I mean, I'm not Mr. Cool or anything, but he just seemed like a kind of like a little bit of a nerdy kid. And I was wondering about his image. You
yeah.
know,
well, maybe, I mean, personality comes into play a lot, especially in management, because you're really the face of the business. When you know the owner's not around and stuff like that, so
absolutely.
So like I think personality, me personally, if I'm hiring in that sort of position, I'm definitely going a lot on personality versus just hard evidence of what you've done and what you've accomplished.
100%,
you know,
100%.
So that must have been what they were looking at, you know.
Right.
And obviously they made the decision to hire you.
Yeah, they did. And I was
were you nervous? Were you like, I mean, especially coming into, it's different if you're like in a nook area in isolated America,
right?
And like you might see like five customers a day or something like that. You know what I mean? But now you're going into a place that's like in the highest traffic area at the highest traffic time of that area. Mm. Like, how are you feeling going into that?
Yeah, I mean, the thing with me is, I think there's a certain. I don't know if it's naivety or I sort of live in the moment a bit, you know, for good and mm-hmm. for bad. So I think I don't remember feeling specifically nervous going into it, but about, you know, being able to do it, you know, I mean,
yeah.
I guess I just thought I'd figure it out. But what I was most self-conscious about was the staff.
Okay.
I mean, there was staff there that had been there for years.
Right.
Some
sure.
of them.
And now they're hiring just this kid off the street.
Exactly.
Basically.
Not internal, an external hire, you know, yeah. which I have learned about since. But
right.
So I was trying to be there for sort of like I wanted to be accepted by them.
Sure.
You know, I was like, okay, I'm in there. I'm supposed to be their superior. But at the same time, like I'm trying to win them over.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
it was a bit of a tricky dynamic to play right there.
Sure. So you worked there for how long?
Gosh, I was there. In that location for about 5.5 years.
Wow. So this must have been where you kind of got your foundation for understanding the coffee world, right?
Yeah. I would, for sure. I definitely got my foundation there. It was very significant. I learned a lot about sort of traditional Italian way of preparing coffee. And mm-hmm.
At this time, had you traveled to Italy?
No, at this time I had traveled nowhere.
Nowhere.
I'd been to,
yeah,
like,
you
Florida.
Were from Bristol
yeah.
to Boston to Fort Lauderdale.
Yeah,
basically.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, when I came here, though, this is what part of what opened my eye, like changed my life. Like coming to Boston, it was so international.
Right.
And I'm from this little town, Bristol, Rhode Island. It's
yeah.
very insular.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, driving to Boston's like a big deal.
Yeah.
Right. It's like an
yeah.
hour away, pretty
sure.
much.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, but I met my staff. I had people from Colombia, from Brazil. I ended up going that first year. I ended up traveling to Colombia, and then I think the next year I went to Brazil. So
wow.
I mean, I went from
yeah.
going nowhere to going to South America twice.
Nice.
You know?
Oh, cool.
So yeah. that was a really just amazing part.
Sure. So you were learning a lot, I'm sure, at that point in time. And so, like, how does it go from now you're the manager at this beautiful Italian cafe on Newbury Street, which I'm sure, you know, that's a prestigious job to have, especially as a younger guy, you know?
Yeah.
And then, so how does that transition into, you know what, I want to open up my own place?
Yeah, so, I mean, the evolution was a little longer than it might seem. I mean, I would say that gave me confidence that I didn't have for sure. I was always a bit insecure of myself. I think I always talked about myself as a jack of all trades, master of none. You know, I came mm-hmm. from a family where my father and my sister are incredibly talented artists.
Yeah.
And I'm sort of like, you know, decent at different sports and stuff and, you know, okay at this, okay at that, but not great in anything.
Sure.
So.
But you seem to have a drive to you too, though. You know, like, I think, are you like, you must be a competitive person.
Yeah, no, I'm definitely competitive. That's true. I mean, Yeah, growing up, I mean, I could have a competition flipping coins. I mean, anything, yeah. You know, I'm pretty competitive.
Sure.
I mean, one of the more competitive people I know, especially growing up. Mm-hmm. But it's weird. There's this... At the same time, there's part of me that can get frustrated or... Like, for example, baseball. I played, you know, T-ball in maybe Little League 1 year, but I wasn't good at it, so I gave up.
Right. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So you get frustrated quickly. Just kind of move aside from that.
Yes.
Yeah. So I'm trying to kind of find out where, you know, so 5.5 years you're working there. Did you leave because you decided, you know what, I want to do my own thing?
Well, actually, so it went through some ownership changes. And at one point, Starbucks acquired us, but we still were run independently, you know, run as Toro Passione.
Yep.
And... But then Starbucks was finally going to shut it down. And we had a whole, like, party, you know, ending sort of celebration, saying goodbye, you know, we had a lot of loyal customers. And at that point, I wanted to, yeah, that was the first, that's a great point. At that time, I thought maybe I could take over the space. How can I do this? How can I get the money?
Right.
You know, I was still pretty naive to financing and all that.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
There was this one regular customer, this old Italian guy. I shouldn't say old if he... Ricardo. He has Ricardo on Newbury Street.
Is he still older?
Well, now he's older. Classic store. That's just... He huge presence on Newbury Street. You know, still there. His son runs the business now.
What's the business called?
Ricardi.
Ricardi?
Yeah.
I think I've seen it.
Beautiful Italian clothes. I mean, it's very...
very high-end.
High-end, yeah. And, but he... We had a great rapport, and he was going to maybe back me.
Mm-hmm.
So we went to the landlord and talked about me taking it over, and there was a little... glitch of some sort that I don't even remember, but he decided he didn't want to do that. You
okay,
know?
Yeah.
Something about the control of the lease, like we couldn't sell the business without the landlord's approval.
Okay, yeah.
If we grew it to be successful.
Right.
So anyways, I all of a sudden needed some sort of backing. There was a guy who owned a tea shop above me, this guy from Sri Lanka. He, you know, he was interested in the space, and it's, long story short, he ended up taking up ownership of it, and I... continued to essentially manage it for him with a bit of a profit share to give me more of an incentive.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. So in my mind, it's like, okay, I didn't want to just manage for someone else. At least I'm sort of making some progress, right?
Yeah.
Like
now
I'm,
you're part of the company, essentially.
Exactly.
It
it's
could
not
be a small
like,
part, but I mean, still, if that place was to sell, just like what the situation was, you know, then at least you get a payout.
Exactly.
Cool.
Exactly. And yeah. I think, and that was my mindset. It's like, okay, it's not the ideal scenario for me where I wanted to be, but going back, it was probably a good next step.
Yeah.
It was probably a better scenario. And, but you know, we didn't quite see things eye to eye, you know, I was probably a little naive still and not focused on a lot of the business aspects, like the cost and the control. He was very focused on that. I mean, he was paying the bills.
Right.
So eventually we decided to amicably split up and
yep. So now you're back.
Yeah, so
back
now on... so now I'm back in the dole and I need a job. So I'm like, okay, what can I do?
Right.
So I go back to Starbucks and sheepishly and I'm just like, hey, you know,
yeah.
Basically applied for work with them, you know, and I had an in because they had known me because I ran this Toro Passione under their umbrella.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So I got a job managing a Starbucks in Government Center at the Steaming Kettle.
So that's a big transition going from like a very Italian, nice place. Not that Starbucks isn't nice. But,
no.
You know,
I get what you're saying, man.
But I mean, it's a big transition to go from like a mom and pop back to going to like a corporate. Right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I was in there training. I had my little Starbucks visor on, you know, and I have my little, I'm wearing like a 10-minute timer, they called it.
Yeah.
You know, it's literally you're wearing a timer on your apron to tell you to go.
You have to complete this or the you got to go
clean up the condiment station, you know, every 10 minutes.
Oh, okay.
So, I mean, I didn't do that regularly, but I had to train. They make you train under every.
But this is also good, you know, experience to get too, because. You know, when you're running your own thing, if you're not kind of like being responsible for these types of things, then they can probably get out of hand pretty quickly. So, I mean, there's a reason they have these things in set in these corporate environments, right?
Definitely.
But I mean, it does take away the feel of like, hey, neighbor, you know?
I mean, it took away that, and it took away... I mean, they still have their regulars and all that, but what it mainly took away from me was, to be quite honest, was the coolness factor.
Right.
I mean, like you said, I'm on Newbury Street. I'm in this hip cafe. I'm coming into my own. I'm gaining confidence. There's, like...
Right,
You know, it's just a great environment, and then I'm going to this thing where it's like I got to wear my little Starbucks apron. It took away all the individuality.
Sure.
I mean, I'd wear a suit sometimes at the place on Newbury Street. You know, I mean, we dressed up. I mean,
you dressed nicely.
The bosses were all Italian. I mean, it was all about the shoes and the and whatnot. I mean, it was about the coffee and everything, but it was definitely a big part of it was the experience and the visual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you worked at the Starbucks as a manager for how long?
I want to say a couple years, maybe.
Okay.
Just about. And I was enjoying it. I mean, I was certainly learning things, learning methodologies, learning you know, different procedures. It was very organized.
Yeah.
And a lot of the things actually that I experienced that I took with me, mm-hmm. you know, when I eventually opened my own place. But
So let's get to that. How did you open? You know, where were you when you were like, you know what? I've had enough of this. I really am going to open up my own place, and I'm going to take that leap of faith and see if it works.
Yeah. So for me, there was one more quick step, which I'll just quickly touch on. But basically, leaning towards that, you know, in my mind thinking, I mean, side note here, I don't know if this is worthwhile or not, but we had a managerial meeting when I was at Starbucks. You know, we'd have our, you know, like 10 different managers and our district manager. And at one point, they were having all of us sign a non-compete clause. And I never signed it, you know. And then,
really?
And then he doesn't bring it up. And then 2 weeks later, we have another meeting. And he's like, hey, you know, in front of everybody, hey, Jared, I haven't received your non-compete. So I just tell him, hey, Joe, you know, to be honest, like, I feel like at this point, this is what I know. At some point, I'm going to open up my own place. I don't know when exactly, when that time comes. I'll certainly give as much notice as possible and do it mm-hmm. professionally. But I honestly just can't.
So you were already in the mindset of like, I'm going to.
That's why I wanted to bring that up, because I was definitely thinking that. And you know what? The cool thing was, he heard that answer, never brought it up again.
Really?
Yeah.
So it wasn't mandatory that you needed to sign this. They were just kind of keeping their like ducks in order.
I think so. Yeah. I mean, or if it was mandatory, he didn't follow up on it.
Oh,
you
cool.
know? So,
yeah. No, cool guy.
Yeah, really cool. I mean, I've gone down to see The Cure in Florida. He lives down in Florida now. Anyways.
Yeah. Nice. So you didn't sign this non-compete, and you're like, I'm probably going to open up my own place.
Exactly.
Did you have, like, a business plan ready or anything like that? Or
I had started to tweak on one, you know. I mean, it was mainly just me looking online, sort of pulling stuff that I saw off the line.
Yeah.
You know, it really wasn't much of a plan at this point.
When you're getting a business plan ready together and stuff like that, it's more so to get like a bank to sign off on it, so you can secure some capital, because I'm sure it's like a big investment to open up a cafe, I would imagine.
Yeah, for sure. And
so it's not necessarily needed if you have other ways of kind of securing some like funds.
Exactly. Know? Right. Potentially, yeah. The main reason you would need it, exactly, if you're going to have an investor, or whether that be the bank or a private investor.
Right, yeah.
If you're able to, you know, make it happen, you know, independently of that, then, yeah, you really wouldn't necessarily need one. Probably a good thing to do anyways, just to get you thinking in that mindset, though, of the different costs and that you need to put money aside for.
Right.
But so just to jump back, so I don't sign that non-compete. You know, in my mindset, I'm going to move on. And then all of a sudden, this opportunity... So what happened? I hear about this guy, George Howell.
Okay.
And I'm like, who's this guy? You know, I read an article or something. You know, huge figure in the coffee world. And he does these tastings. So I go to one of his tastings open to the public, and I am literally blown away. I mean, I would say at Torbazione, I learned a foundation. But then this guy, I do a coffee tasting and just realize what it can be. I mean, he looks at coffee literally like wine.
Really?
And I don't want to get too much in the minutiae and the details, because it could
Is he a local? Was he a local guy, or this is a national guy?
Yeah, so he was at the time out in Acton, Western Mass. And his story is, he originally was out in California during the Haight-Ashbury, the Berkeley, you know, Pete's Coffee, all the beginning of these places. And and he worked his way out to the East Coast. But yeah, huge name. I mean, if you Google him, he started this program called Cup of Excellence, which helps to bring farmers out from behind the to bring the focus onto the actual farmer, you know, and what he calls the, you know, the terroir, which is often a wine term, but bringing attention to very specific elements of the coffee, you know, instead of just labeling it under a blend or from one generic area.
So he's the connoisseur of the coffee.
Yeah. So, I mean, I go to this tasting from him, I'm blown away, and I'm just like, oh my God, I need to work with this guy.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm sort of in my mind, like, I still want to do my own cafe, but that doesn't seem to be happening right now, and I just want to work with him. So I reach out to him directly, and with the idea of, like, opening a cafe with him. And he had had a non-compete with Starbucks for a long time, but it had just expired, so he was ready to start to do something.
Yeah.
So I went to work for him. I left Starbucks and, you know, went to work for George Howell. And it was a small company. I was doing everything. I was hired as the main sales guy, but I was doing machine maintenance. I was doing coffee training with cafes that they had, all kinds of different things.
Yeah, yeah. You know? So you're working for George, which really wasn't your main intent. You wanted to work with George, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. So now, but again, now you're in a situation where you're with, you're learning and you kind of found a taste that blew your mind, right?
Exactly. No, I'm learning. So this is like the sort of maybe the final piece or the next piece. I mean, so I manage this cafe in Newbury,
right?
You know, learn the Piaz, the style, the presentation. Then I go to Starbucks and learn all the methodologies and a lot more of the business aspects of running a cafe.
Mm-hmm.
And then I go to George and I'm learning, like,
the product.
Yeah, product, like, mind blown, like, wow, okay. You know, learning top of the line. I mean, I'm at the cutting edge of, like, what's happening in coffee as far as, like, how you're handling the beans, you know, ways of roasting. I mean, companies are sending us equipment on the regular, like, newest equipment, you know, for us to test.
Sure, he was, like, the influencer.
Absolutely.
Influencer in the coffee game.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So how did I finally make that next step? I mean, basically, I was supposed to be doing sales for them. I never was the best salesman. I mean, the coffee was the most expensive coffee out there.
How much would you, like, did they sell it by the pound?
Yeah, like, I mean, if you got a retail bag, you know, the average bag out there at the groceries was going for, like, 5 or 6. His was like 11.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
You know, so I'm trying to go to cafes and be like, oh, you really should switch to this coffee that's way more per pound. And, you know, the cafe owner's like trying to make a buck and he's just like, oh, it's hard to validate this.
Right.
And even I'm like, the quality is amazing, but true. I can see your point. You know, I can see why you might not want to.
It's like going into like the Louis Vuitton store. You know what I mean? Like,
exactly.
Basically. So some people want to kind of stick in their profit margins and don't want to like become the, you know, the specialty store maybe. They're happy with what they have. So, but you must have made some sales. I mean, some people.
I made some. I think what I brought to them more than anything was I retained a lot of clients. They had clients because they were a little out of touch at this point, in the sense that they didn't have a really much of a youth movement in their company. It was a small company. I mean, George is even back then probably in his late 60s. And, so the new movement, the specialty coffee movement, he was a little disconnected from it. So the one thing I did was bridge that gap a little, just purely on being younger and able to relate to a lot of these younger owners.
Yeah.
And there were some big clients that were about, you know, getting close to jump ship, which I, you know, I can say confidently that I helped to keep them on board for a
while. Sure. So you have this specialty coffee, and it's good to know that it – you know, it's out there and it exists. So were you thinking about at that time incorporating this specialty coffee into a specialty cafe?
Yep. Yeah, exactly. At that time, that's where my mind was for sure. I was pretty, that was my highest point of passion about just pure coffee. You know,
yeah,
for sure.
Right.
So what happened was I wasn't bringing in a ton of sales. You know, they had this guy who had a lot of corporate coffee sales. You know, he wasn't experienced with the specialty coffee market, but he was more, you know, Folgers, but, you know, that kind of thing, like,
sure,
more generic coffee.
Yeah.
And so Green. They brought him in. They sort of essentially laid me off.
Okay.
Yeah. Yep. On really good terms, though. I remember being in their office. I teared up a bit and they, you know, felt bad, and I mean, we have a great relationship to this day, but they essentially were the ones that connected me to the spot in Post Office Square.
Yeah, so let's get to that. Yeah. You have a beautiful, beautiful location.
Thank you.
Right there, downtown Boston. I mean, that was going to be a question that I was going to ask. It's like, how do you get a location like that? What was the location prior? And for anyone listening to this, Google Sip Cafe just to take a look at the location, because it is amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, so how did that become available?
So basically, we had a client there who was using our coffee. And in my myriad of positions, you know, sales slash technical slash training, I would go down and they were behind in their bills. So the COO was like, listen, Jared, you got to drop this coffee off and you need to get a check from them or we're not leaving the coffee. Okay. Like normally we ship it out UPS to all the regular customers, but these guys were just having some issues. So I knew about the space. To be honest with you, it was run horribly and it was just no surprise that, I mean, the coffee was always cold. It was just, there was no personality there. It was a small little chain called Z Square. And, so I knew the space was going to be available, and basically the COO put me in touch with essentially the landlord, and you know, sort of, because we had a really great relationship, and basically he set me up with an initial meeting with her.
Okay. Yeah.
And at that point, it was just like, all right, I guess this is.
Yeah. No. So there's the lease, and you had the money ready to go for the lease, and.
I mean, thanks to my lovely wife Abby. I mean, she put a lot of her hard-earned savings into it, you know, and
but she was supporting you, obviously. She knew that this is your passion, and you're gonna make it successful no matter what, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, we did actually get a business loan as well. I should say that. I mean, I did end up, once again, thanks to Abby, I came up with a really, at the time, would seem like a great business plan. And I mean, this is 2009. It wasn't the most ideal time to try to get a loan, and I struck out. I mean, I was just calling place after place after place. And then finally, I call this place, Boston Private Bank. And I tell them, I knew where they were located. I'm like, listen, I'm like, I know I got red flags. I'm a new business owner. It's a new business.
Yeah.
It's a food and beverage business.
Sure.
Three strikes. And, but you can literally see me. I'm like, I can, from your location, from the 10 Post Office Square branch, you can see my cafe in the park in Post Office Square. You know, and at least, and I don't know, not to say that, you know.
No, but I mean, that probably had an impact too, because they're looking at the location directly, right? And they're like, okay, that's where you want to be.
They can see what's happening each day, number one. Number two, we're a local business, right? They pride themselves in being, the time at least, a local branch, you know, a small company.
Right, and I can understand the whole, like, trying to secure capital and getting denied, because, I mean, throughout my life, I've had a pretty terrible credit score, and I'm working on getting it better and stuff like that, but I don't think anyone would probably loan me out, you know, a significant amount in order to start my own business unless I had like the most ingenious business plan ever. So yeah, I mean, I can understand. I mean, all bootstrapped, you know what I mean? It's just, that's just the way I had to do it, basically. So,
which is really ideal. I mean, in many ways, because then you're not, you know, you have that freedom of creativity, right? Sure. I mean, it's all you. I mean, it's a lot of pressure.
Yeah.
You know, and there's that stress element, which I definitely can relate to, and
but
also there's not a bunch of hands in the piggy.
Yeah, right. And you don't have to think about these. You know, if this goes down, it was just, I was all in.
Exactly. You know, exactly.
If this doesn't work, at least I tried my best. Yeah, so.
You were all in. You got nobody to blame. Maybe.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Right. Right. Yeah. No, I understand. So now you've got the location, and so you're thinking, I'm going to go specialty with this.
Yeah. So yeah, at the time, a big part actually of even my business plan was, I remember, education. I thought it never quite came to fruition to what I envisioned it to be, but this part of it, but I thought I'm going to work on educating my customers, my clientele. So all this stuff that I've learned that my mind's been blown about, hey, maybe their minds will get blown too, you know?
Right, yeah, because at this time, it was really more of a niche kind of thing, right? So it's like not a lot of people understand when you're going to a specialty cafe or a place that serves better quality drinks, you know, what that actually tastes like, first of all, and what that actually means, right?
Absolutely. I mean, back then, I would, once again, give a shout-out to Simon. Forgetting your last name, Simon, but there was this one place called Simon's on Mass Ave, 1776 Mass Ave, that I would go to, and he was like the place.
Yeah.
You know, and there really wasn't a ton. I mean, there were some small little places here or there, high rise, you know, bakery and cafe. They were doing it right, but not many people.
Yeah.
You know, and so yeah, at the time, I mean.
So were your price points a little bit higher than, let's say, going to Dunkey's or going to Starbucks?
No, not really, because the bad business person, you know, that I was, not him anymore, hopefully, but I was so paranoid about the competition, actually.
Sure.
So yeah. I was always trying to, keep my stuff, my prices in line.
Okay.
Maybe slightly more, but I was trying to compete with them.
Right,
That was my biggest mistake in the early days, is I was trying to compete as opposed to differentiate.
Okay, yeah.
I mean, I wanted to differentiate, and I was doing that within the cafe, but I kind of was half-assed doing it.
Yeah, you wanted to differentiate based on taste.
Yeah,
and quality. Yeah, and weren't really aligning taste and price, basically.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, in location. I mean, now, like, I see the value in where
location.
We are.
Yeah, totally.
It's like that alone. Like,
right.
Ups things.
Warrants a little bit higher price.
For sure.
I mean, yeah, it's just, and it's an experience, too. It's a different experience.
Yeah.
And people are willing to pay for experience and, for sure, education and, you know, feeling a status a lot of times, too.
Yeah.
And when you're going to a place that has George Howell coffee,
mm-hmm.
that's a status thing.
Oh, it definitely is. Yeah. And you know, like I said, back then there just wasn't much around us, so
right.
it definitely stood out.
Yeah.
Now there's a lot more around, so you got to stand out in different ways. But yeah, for sure, that was a big aspect to it.
Cool. And so you've been in business how long?
13 years.
13 years. Congratulations.
Yeah. Thanks.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, 2009. I remember the day, April 15th.
Yeah. So you've obviously experienced a lot of highs and lows, I'm sure, as being in business, as we all are.
Oh my God, yeah.
Yeah. Any particular highs or lows that stand out?
Well, I mean, a high was, I can still remember everyone that I had, like that first crew, you know, the first day before we opened,
mm-hmm.
or first night, I should say. We were there, you know, many a night, just painting things, cleaning things, just trying to get things as great as possible for that first day. And I can still picture the night before, just the staff, the crew, you know, the core people being there and the expressions on their face and what they were doing and just that excitement to know, like,
sure.
wow, tomorrow we're going to open this place.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I remember that first day I had on my custom suit, the one suit I had that was, you know, this great suit. And yeah, we were
open. Oh, it's a great feeling.
Huh? It just was an awesome feeling.
Yeah.
You know? It felt really amazing. And then, when I didn't have like tons of customers pouring in that first day, like on Newbury Street,
mm-hmm.
I think I naively thought somehow that would just happen.
Right,
know?
Sure, yeah.
But I should say, like, within a few days, we were pretty busy because we were in a prime location. It was basically like all the office workers would come down, and there was a big, what essentially is like a quad, like in college,
yeah.
you know, they just come down and have lunch, you know, so.
Yeah.
So we were the new place in town, and we'd had signs up for a while saying we're going to be opening soon, you know?
Right,
so,
right. So you get gaining the excitement for people around
yeah,
there and everything.
We got bum rushed. I mean, there's so many situations where I, you know, looking back, I didn't know what to expect, you know? And
yeah.
Just had
right.
to adapt.
Hey,
you know?
You're just living in the moment, you know?
Yeah.
That's exactly what it is. You got to be good at adapting
yeah.
because so that things will just get thrown your way. You're not, you can never prepare for everything. Right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, we got crushed. I remember we had lines out the door, and our sandwiches were taking. We were trying. We thought we could do all the sandwiches to order somehow.
Yeah.
And the setup we had wasn't made for that, and people were waiting 25 minutes for a sandwich. You know, in the financial
yeah.
district, it was crazy.
Right. They're like on a 15-minute break.
Yeah.
Like, got to get back to the office.
Yeah.
Like, dude, could you deliver this?
That wasn't going
to
cut it. So we quickly had to adapt. And over the weekend, we changed up the operation completely. And by the beginning of the next week, we had it, you know, a much better system.
Sure. Yeah. So some of the struggles that you've gone through.
Yeah. I mean, just, I would say biggest one's just financial. I mean,
yeah.
just that stress, which I assume maybe you've experienced, of just like, how am I going to make payroll?
It's
you know,
always
like, how
like
am
that.
I mean, my least concern was how am I going to pay myself? That wasn't even in the tip of my mind. It was more like, how am I going to pay my bills and how
mm-hmm.
am I going to pay my staff?
Right. Yeah.
I mean, like, I can remember electric bill building up, like putting off electric bills, you know, sure. and then doing partial payments. And
oh, yeah. Been there, too. I know.
Not fun.
No, it's not fun. It's extremely stressful.
Oh,
you
my
know?
Gosh.
It's like these all these joys of, you know, being your own boss and kind of doing your own thing and specializing. And then it's just like reality comes in pretty quickly and there's bills to pay, you know, and
Absolutely.
You need to be constantly innovating and thinking of like, well, okay, how do I get people in the door?
Exactly. Right?
And that's just like, that's the ongoing challenge. And you just want to continue to hopefully progress in a good direction. So you've tried other things though, right? So I know you had a satellite stand.
Oh yeah,
over in
so,
the in Faneuil Hall.
Yeah, so I would say, after about, you know, first year always takes a while. I would say our prime point was probably like 2 or 3 years in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were doing decently well, and someone had approached me, a customer. He was a regular customer, named Ted First, and he had talked to me about doing something in maybe South Station at one point. Didn't think I was ready at the time, and then he came by and said, "Hey, like, would you want to do something, you know, over in Faneuil Hall? I found this spot. I think it could be great." And, you know, for me at the time, things seemed to be going pretty smoothly at SIP. I had a good staff. I had a manager. And so I said, sure, let's try it out, you know. So we ended up opening up this business called Cafe Pulse, which Pulse, P-U-L-S-E. And that was basically a seasonal business. In fact, you worked there for a little
while. I did work there, yeah. Yeah, no, I did work there. I mean, it was busy, man. I mean, Saturday, especially weekends.
Weekends, yeah.
You know, weekends would come in. It was just like the rush of the boats coming off from the waterfront.
The cruises.
It was just people from all over come there. And that's great, you know what I mean? But, like, at the same time, you don't get those same repeat diehard customers from that.
Absolutely.
But it's pretty much guaranteed that, like, every Saturday there's going to be 1,000-plus people
rushing
through there.
And I mean, that was a tough operation, which you experienced. I mean, we didn't have no plumbing. So essentially nothing was plumbed in. So, I mean, we had to carry in our water, fresh water, and we had to carry out our wastewater.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I know.
That was not fun.
No, that's not fun. But I mean, just, it's something you kind of have to do in a situation like that with a satellite location.
Right,
and
yeah.
It's kind of like a cart stand.
Exactly.
Type,
it really was.
Deal.
It was really a glorified cart. It was essentially a cart that we just we maximized. I think management was a little bit like, oh, wow, these guys are really like pushing the limits here. You know what I mean?
Sure. Yeah.
We expanded that space. We had all rolling units that we built, you know, so we could really, we had a, essentially just a box, you know, which we had steel doors, roll up doors, and every morning you'd roll up the doors and then you'd sort of push out everything from the inside.
Mm-hmm.
It was sort of like this game of Tetris. And,
So was that successful for you?
Yeah, I would say it definitely helped to bring in some extra revenue. I mean, it was a big headache though. So mentally, you know, it took a lot of attention away from SIP.
Right. Why did you decide to go with a, like, an off-brand from SIP and not incorporate?
Basically because I was going in 50-50 with this guy.
Okay,
and he wanted, you know, he's got a really good sound business mind.
Sure.
He has a business
so
background.
So he wasn't at that time coming into the SIP business.
Exactly.
Right.
Looking back, maybe I should have, I didn't even think about that. You know, it was just like, hey, here's this person approaching me. He's got the idea. It's going to be a separate business. We did our own LLC, you know, separately. And it was definitely a separate business. The tricky part for me was I had to manage, you know, keep an eye on SIP where it was just me, and then also maintain this business where I have a partner now.
Right.
So it's almost like in my eyes, I have someone that I'm reporting to, right? So it was a tricky balancing act.
Sure.
And as a result, actually, SIP, I think I took my eye off the ball a bit there. Mm-hmm. And it struggled a little because of
that. Yeah, because it would have been great to have like a little satellite SIP location for branding purposes.
Absolutely.
Because now you've got your brand going out there to, again, this rush of influx of people who have never heard of it before. You know?
Absolutely. And that's a great point. I mean, it was tough. I mean, I would try to cross brand it when I was out there working it. You know, I'd try to tell them, hey, you should come over to SIP sometime too. And, you know, did what little whatever word of mouth I could, but
right, yeah,
but there was certainly no clear connection.
It was a total. There was a disconnect there.
Absolutely.
So anyway, moving forward from Pulse, you've met this guy Ted, and now you've kind of developed a rapport with him, and I understand he's now incorporated into SIP.
He is, yeah. So, God, the time goes by so fast, especially with COVID. But I would say
there must have been something you saw in Ted that you maybe felt like, you know what, I lack in that. This would be...
I mean, hey, to be completely frank, I mean, I did see something in him. I saw it when we worked together at Pulse. I mean, he just was incredibly organized. He was always thinking about the next thing that we should be doing.
Right.
I would tend to be a little complacent, to be completely honest. I mean, I think, I don't know that I fit the stereotype of the entrepreneur out there. I mean, I think I've, you know, managed to fall on my feet, so to speak, at different times. But anyways, Ted brought a lot of things to the table that I didn't necessarily feel that I had.
In the technical, more business sense.
Exactly.
Because you truly were, and probably still are and have been, the face of SIP, right?
True enough. I mean, I tend to downsell what I bring to the table, and that's what's so great about our current partnership is that we're so opposites that we balance each other incredibly well. It's really an ideal partnership. And so what I saw, I think, is that possibility. You know, I thought I saw my weaknesses and started to know, you know, his as well, and realized, oh, okay, I'm strong where he's weak. He's strong where I'm weak. This could work out.
Yeah.
You know, and so we've been partners about 3 years now.
Sure. And so what has transitioned since that, in that time frame?
Oh, this is the other part I guess I left out, which is a little humbling. But so after 10 years of having SIP,
right,
I was, you know, I wasn't sure about the future. You know, I really wasn't. And so I approached Ted and said, listen, I know you've expressed interest in getting involved at SIP and you see the potential there of what it could be.
Right.
Would you want to, you know, come on board with me?
Okay, yeah.
You know, because completely... Because
this is giving out, you know, this is your baby. This is, you saw the vision, you created the vision, you secured the funding for it, you know, you have everyone involved in it. You know, this is kind of your thing.
It's,
so.
Yeah, really true. And it was really sort of tough to do because of that. But it was sort of like in my mind, I knew, hey, you know, talking to myself, Jared, either you're going to bring this guy in and make this business really successful, or maybe it's time to call it quits. You know, you gave it your all.
Yep.
You know, you tried, but for whatever reasons, it wasn't going to, you know, you gave it a 10-year run, which is solid, more than a lot of businesses.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
You know, it might be time to call it quits. And so I said, you know, hey, Ted, you know, a little, you know, humbled, and I went to him. And anyways, I mean...
He shared the vision
at
that point.
Yeah, he shared the vision. I mean, I would say at that point, he had the vision.
Did he reignite
He reignited. Exactly.
See, that's
no,
great.
I was like semi like down about the... I mean, definitely not more than semi down about the business. I mean, I didn't see the vision.
Yeah, yeah.
He had the whole idea about the beer garden and bringing in the beer and wine and a deck and all this stuff. And I just thought, really? Like... Mainly, I knew he was going to inject some cash into the business, and I was going to be able to continue.
Sure.
Little did I know that it would get to the point of where it is now.
Yeah, yeah. So so he's in now, and he's got the vision, and you're both on board with the vision. So then you mentioned beer garden.
Oh, yeah. Now it's a huge part of the business. I mean, we have a beer and wine and cordial license, so we offer – we have about 12 to 13 beers on tap. We have – cider, we have Truly on tap.
So you've gone from specialty lattes to specialty.
Yeah, we're doing
cocktails.
Blueberry margaritas now, espresso martinis. So yeah, it's really switched, and it's funny because it coincided, especially during COVID. I got really into cocktail mixing at home, and I'm still very passionate about the coffee, but I
but
guess
there
I'm,
was an opportunity there to
exactly.
expand into different markets, pretty much.
Ultimately, now the business has a huge future. I mean, as far as what the future entails, I mean, really, it feels limitless right now. I mean, we're having customers come in probably an average of 3 days a week, and
wow.
we're blowing away any numbers I ever did or ever thought I could do.
That's,
you know,
great.
In the past. So
yeah. Yeah. No,
it feels really good.
That's awesome. And you built the deck up and everything. And so, and you're also hosting functions, right?
Yep. Yeah. After work, we oftentimes have companies come down, maybe a law firm, you know, financial firm come down, and that we can hold. I mean, we've done some parties with 200 guests. The average, I would say, is probably 40 to 50. Mm-hmm. But they can rent out a section of our deck. They can have access to the service window. They're surrounded by trees. They're in the middle of downtown. I mean, people can see them. It's a beautiful spot, you know.
And yeah, yeah. So how would somebody be able to reach out to secure renting out the spot from you?
Yeah, great question. Best way, you could certainly visit our website, www.sipboston.com. We have some information there, links. Really, Ted, my business partner, is handling all of that right now, Ted First. You can email him at ted@sipboston.com or even ted@thinkfirst.com. That's F-U-R-S-T.
Cool.
So.
Yeah, no, that's great. So wrapping pretty much everything up, like what does it all mean to you, you know, being a business owner, kind of creating your specialty that you've created, and having an open future, you know, like knowing that this is just kind of where we are today, but you know, future's wide open.
It's a really good question. I guess for me right now, I feel a lot of things about it. I mean, I don't feel that stress that I used to feel, to be completely honest. I mean, all the financial stress, like Ted he handles all the business side of that. So I really don't even worry about it too much. I mean, I'm obviously trying to make the cafe as efficient as possible and, you know, worrying about costs, and I'm doing all the orders. So there's plenty of daily stresses, but in the grand scheme of things, I'm just in a great place. I mean, I'm seeing the benefits, you know, on a monthly basis as to being able to contribute to my household, you know, more. I just feel great being able to actually participate more, you know, with the family bills and help my, you know, wife out and my family out. I feel like the future just, I mean, Ted just has grand visions, and I'm on board, you know, I'm just sort of on board and a willing passenger and just excited to see where we can go.
That's awesome.
Yep.
That's great. So to wrap things up, I got a couple would you rathers that I've kind of sourced out. So I'd love to hear your answers on these. You could keep it simple. Just would you rather X or Y?
Okay.
All right, ready? And they have really nothing to do with anything that we've been talking about. So would you rather go into the past and meet your ancestors or go into the future and meet your great-great-grandchildren? Going to the future. Would you rather have more time or more money?
More time.
More time. Would you rather have a rewind button or a pause button on your life? Rewind button or a pause button?
Rewind.
Would you rather be able to talk with animals or speak all foreign languages?
Speak all foreign languages.
Really? Over the animals?
I mean, that's a tough one.
Yeah.
It's a really tough one.
Yeah, that
but I've
is
always
a tough
won.
One.
I only speak English, so I'm
sure, yeah. Well, there's time to you know, there's always
learn.
Time to
Well,
learn.
I can learn how to speak to animals too.
Would you rather win the lottery or live twice as long?
I'll go twice as long. Assuming my health is, you know, that's
still
very health dependent, right?
Okay, health dependent. Yeah. Put an asterisk on that one.
Yeah.
Would you feel worse if no one showed up at your wedding or to your funeral?
I guess I would feel worse if no one showed up at my wedding, because at my funeral, maybe most of my friends are dead already.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
But I've thought about that before.
Yeah,
actually,
so you're assuming that all your friends are alive and able to go to your wedding.
Well, and at my wedding, I would know it, right? At my funeral, if they don't show up,
yeah, you
I don't
really
know.
Know.
So.
Sure. would you rather meet George Washington or Bill Clinton?
George Washington,
the founding father.
George Washington.
Okay. There's only a couple more.
I mean,
more.
Clinton would be cool too, but...
Yeah, but George Washington,
yeah.
Cooler. Would you rather lose your vision or your hearing?
Oh my God, I've thought of this so many times, and I have such a hard time with it. Are we assuming you've had them previous? Oh, lose it.
Okay. Yeah, lose your vision or your hearing.
Lose my vision or my hearing. Oh God. I'm going to go with hearing.
Lose your hearing?
Yeah.
Would you rather work more hours per day, but fewer days, or work fewer hours per day, but more days? Work more hours per day, fewer days. Fewer hours per day, more days.
More hours per day, fewer days, especially in the past. But in this exact time, I actually like the idea of less hours, more days.
Okay, less hours, more days. Yep. And this is the final one, and I'm going to need you to elaborate a little bit on your answer to this one. Would you rather be stuck on a broken ski lift or in a broken elevator?
Oh, definitely on a broken ski lift. Yeah. You get a beautiful view. You know, you got the air flowing. I mean, yeah. It's not raining or downpouring.
Oh, I mean, it would be rough being stuck in a broken elevator.
I was one in New York once.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
pressing, like, the buttons?
Oh, yeah. It was halfway between. And it ended up, someone came and opened it. We had to, like, crawl out. I mean, I was with some good company, so that wasn't a bad,
horrible,
but it was definitely a little
weird. Yeah, no, it could just be you and another person on a ski lift, or it could just be you by yourself, you know, and depending on who that person is.
Exactly. I just like to say that I'm very notoriously indecisive, so these are very challenging.
No, and that was good. You actually, you answered them with a lot of conviction. All right, Jared, well, thank you so much for coming on to the Basement Buzz podcast at Diversity Consignment. Really appreciate you taking the time off and coming and talking with me.
Oh, it was a pleasure. I really appreciate you asking me, and I'm just so proud of all you've done at Diversity Consignment. It's a great store, and I recommend everyone come out here and check it out when you're in JP.
All right, man. Take it easy.
All right. Thanks.